Welcome to Built to Play, games and technology for the arts inclined. I'm Armin Nagbali.
And I'm Daniel Rosen, breaking our hiding security. It's likely the winter break when you're hearing this, so there's no news and no interviews, and also no place to hide.
Instead, we'll be talking one of our favorite series, and it's one Daniel's done a ton of research for. It's Metal Gear Solid.
We'll be talking about the nonsense ride from quirky stealth game to one of the strangest franchises out of Japan.
So expect a lot of...
nanomachines.
And...
Jack!
This week, it's time to put on makeup, it's time to light the lights, it's time to meet the Patriots on Metal Gear Tonight.
We're talking about the nuttiest of them all, Metal Gear Solid 2, including an interview with translator Agnes Kaku.
But Metal Gear Solid 2 is a doozy, so before we get into that, we have to tell you why this is easily the worst game in the series.
So, since this is the game that was advertised by No Place to Hide, we better jump into the series of... oh, the story of Jack and Rose, but not that Jack and Rose, the other ones who might be computer programs.
Metal Gear Solid 2, 2001. But before we get started on all of this, I want to make the point that we'll get more and fleshed out as we continue through these games. Hideo Kojima is the world's most arrogant game designer.
He came out of Metal Gear Solid 1, I think, very disappointed in his fan base.
I think he was really happy with it. He was disappointed that the fans just wanted another Metal Gear Solid game, and that's not what he wanted to make, gosh darn it.
He wanted to make a movie. Or something that could really touch people.
He wanted to say something with meaning, not just this dumb military whatever. But that arrogance kind of colors Metal Gear Solid 2 development in that sense, because the whole game is a backlash hissy fit at what people wanted out of Metal Gear Solid. Anyway, originally, the game was going to be called Metal Gear Solid 3, III, to symbolize Manhattan's three tallest towers. Before that, it was less crazy.
He wanted to tell the story of Solid Snake fighting Liquid Snake again as he hijacked an aircraft carrier carrying a Metal Gear and flew it to Iran.
The situation in the Middle East got pretty dicey around that time, and they dropped the plot in favor of something more New York-centric.
Kojima understood that what fans wanted was a real sequel to Metal Gear Solid, so he threw in the world's wildest curveball.
MGS2 does not star Snake, at least not after the first hour or two, as Armin may mention. That's a spoiler now, but at the time of release, every bit of PR and every screenshot was put together to make you think that it was going to be another entire game about Solid Snake.
So it was a total freakout.
People freaked out.
But it was a mostly a fakeout. Snake is playable for the tutorial tanker chapter, and then Raiden is the true main character.
Which is hilarious, because Snake is on the box in America, as if he's the main character, and he's not in Japan. Raiden's on the box in Japan.
But Raiden's character was not exactly popular.
He's controversial, to say the least. He's whiny, he's a complete newbie, he needs everything explained to him, and he has the world's most annoying girlfriend.
Which we will get into right now. In the tanker chapter, Snake infiltrates an oil tanker owned by the American Navy to leak photos of their new Metal Gear Ray to the public.
As you might remember from last time, Snake has retired from Super Soldierdom again for the third time, I think, and is now working with Otacon and funded by Nastasha Romanenko as part of Philanthropy, an NGO that basically tries to get rid of Metal Gears. Well... on the tanker, he learns that there are Russian mercenaries led by Revolver Ocelot and the Gerlukovich family, Olga and her father, are trying to hijack the Metal Gear for their own ends.
Ocelot then reveals that he's working for himself the whole time, shoots Daddy
Gerlukovich,
bang!
And then jacks the Metal Gear.
Then he gets possessed by the ghost of Liquid Snake, starts yelling,
"Brothers!"
and swims off into the sunset.
Oh, and he blows up the tanker. Mission over.
Woo!
Smash cut to 2 years later. Raiden's mission is to undercover a big shell oil cleanup facility off the coast of Manhattan. During a routine visit, the president is kidnapped by the terrorists calling themselves the Sons of Liberty, whose leader claims to be and looks just like Solid Snake.
He doesn't actually look very much like Solid Snake, but the game insists he does, which after Liquid should really be your first hint that he's a clone or a brother or something.
So the Sons of Liberty are backed up by Dead Cell, a crack anti-terror squad gone rogue, made up of Fortune, a woman with a railgun who can't be shot and wants to be so bad, you guys. Fat Man, a demolition expert on roller skates. Vamp, an unkilling, blood-sucking knife thrower, uses dance moves to dodge foes. And he was crucified in a Romanian church and drank the blood of his parents. That's why they called him Vamp, because he's bisexual? Is that true?
That is 100% true. The name Vamp has nothing in-universe to do with the fact that he is a vampire, that he's unkillable and likes to drink blood and calls some women his queens of the night. No, he's bisexual, and that's why he's vamp.
That's weird. It's kind of like going to Dracula and saying, I'm going to call you Dracula because of that nice cape.
Because you're Dracool.
Yeah.
So, Raiden is sent on here basically by Colonel Campbell, mm-hmm. who is still on the codec. Also on the codec is Rosemary.
We should mention what the codec is, by the
way. Oh, yeah. We hadn't mentioned it before. The codec is the radio system. It's a tiny little microscopic radio that goes in the operative's ear so they can talk to their various, mission commands.
Yes.
Including the commanding officer, Colonel Roy Campbell.
And which was a big part of the last game, is also the way you kind of communicated with a lot of your members and was, at one point, the solution to getting through a certain area by looking at the back of the box.
Yeah, you had to, at some point in Metal Gear Solid 1, you have to call Meryl, and you don't know her codec frequency. Her codec frequency is actually on the back of the Metal Gear Solid 1 disc case.
Yep.
Good luck if you don't have that.
Yep. So,
so you have Colonel Campbell, and basically your only other major codec member is Raiden's girlfriend, Rosemary, or Rose. They accompany him along with Peter Stillman, who is a demolitions expert who trained Fat Man. He dies at some point. After spending about 70 years running errands for him, Raiden comes into confrontation with the guy calling himself Solid Snake, as well as a Navy SEAL Green Beret named Iroquois Plissken.
Plissken tells Raiden that the terrorist leader isn't Snake. He's a different guy, because Plissken is Snake!
Raiden shrugs and keeps looking for the president, who reveals to Raiden that the Big Shell isn't a cleanup facility. It's a Metal Gear production plant built by the Navy.
They're on top of Arsenal Gear, which I'm assuming is the football team, the soccer team?
Yeah. Arsenal Gear, a football team comprised of a giant Metal Gear that sits underwater and produces smaller Metal Gears.
There we go. And it houses an onboard AI called GW, a computer capable of controlling all electronic transmissions in the world, which seems like a unnecessary leap for if you're just going to make a Metal Gear.
Right. There's actually one of the engineers, well, we'll get to her in a bit, there is only one way to turn off GW, and that is a virus disk that becomes sort of the MacGuffin of the game about halfway through. Arsenal Gear and GW are also the top weapons of the Patriots, a secret shadow organization that runs the U.S. government and renders democracy a sham.
Oh, and the terrorist leader? He's not Solid Snake. He's Solidus Snake, and he's better known as President George Sears, who somehow no one recognized.
Former president. By the way, this is the president that Ocelot was speaking with at the end of Metal Gear Solid 1, so, I mean, take a drink. He's betrayed someone again.
Bang!
Yeah, somehow everybody... He's on the news. They have pictures of the terrorist leader calling himself Solid Snake, and he looks like the If George W. Bush was conducting terrorist attacks and said, no, I'm Osama bin Laden too, and everybody just believed him, that's what we'd be looking at.
That's a pretty weird leap, and I can't... This is a game filled with a lot of weird, like, just explanations for things that don't need to be explained, and also no explanations for things that need a ton of
explanation. Yeah. Before we get there, after having Ocelot orchestrate the terrorist attack on Shadow Moses, Solidus had a falling out with the Patriots and has now gone rogue.
Ocelot then kills the president for no other reason than it be fun. Ocelot is chaotic and evil, so...
No, he's like D&D. No, like his D&D. His alignment. He's chaotic neutral as all hell. Chaotic evil, rather. He's just whatever. I'll kill everybody. Boom, boom, boom. Around this time, Raiden pops a bunch of diazepam and has a sniper battle with Vamp to save the life of Emma Emmerich, an engineer on the Arsenal Gear project and Otacon's half sister that he may have slept with. She has the virus key that Vamp is trying to keep out of Raiden's hand.
She dies. Vamp doesn't. Raiden sucks. Then Snake betrays Raiden and Olga, who's still around and wearing a kick-ass cyber ninja suit, and hands him off to Solidus to get tortured.
Solidus strips Raiden naked, tells him that he adopted Raiden, a former child soldier, as his son during the Liberian Civil War, when he was known as Jack the Ripper.
This is my son. I taught him everything.
Again, this is now Raiden's adopted father and the former president. How does Raiden not look at this guy and say, oh, you? Hey.
I remember you. You're the president.
President Dad, how are you doing?
I forgot that I was the first son.
Also, Raiden is a Patriot spy and everything he's known in his entire life is a lie.
Olga frees Raiden, revealing that she's a double agent working for the Patriots, not the Sons of Liberty. She wants to be free, but the Patriots have her daughter.
Who is not referred to as a daughter at this point, just child. At one point, Snake says son, and that's embarrassing for him. Snake handed over Raiden initially so he could get into Arsenal gear, and now that he is in Arsenal gear, he gives Raiden a very phallic katana, some clothes, and tells him to choose your own legacy.
Raiden's destiny involves cutting up a million ninjas and 25 Metal Gear Rays, because if you're going to make up for 15 hours of being an awful protagonist, you might as well do it in style.
Meanwhile, Raiden's CEO, Colonel Campbell, starts going completely insane, looking like an Assassin's Creed Unity NPC with his face textures ripped off, quoting Metal Gear Solid for the Game Boy, talking about the Lolly Lule Low.
I'm not home right now. Please leave a message after the beep.
Beep. Just complete madness.
It turns out the colonel had, and that Raiden's been talking to the whole game is a construct of the GWAI, who is under orders from the Patriots to recreate the conditions that made Solid Snake into a super soldier. Also, Rose, Raiden's girlfriend, reveals that she was a Patriot plant the whole time, starts insulting him, and Raven reveals she's pregnant, and then she gets cut off.
I'm pregnant, John.
Oh no!
Ocelot steps in and shoots Olga, revealing he's a triple agent. He's been working for the Patriots this whole time!
Bang!
And then Liquid's arm takes over again, and then he seals a Metal Gear Ray to hunt down the Patriots?
I don't think we mentioned the part earlier, or maybe we glossed over it really quickly, and we should really highlight the fact that at some point, Revolver Ocelot grafted Liquid Snake's arm to his severed arm, because he got it cut off by Cyborg Ninja and MGS1. We didn't mention that part.
No.
Because it wasn't relevant then. Now, he grafts Liquid Snake's arm to his, and the ghost of Liquid Snake is possessing him through the arm and causing him to betray people more than he otherwise would. Also, he gets to yell,
"Brothers!"
a bunch, and then move his arm up, because that's in control now.
Snake dives after him in some sort of crazy Pavlovian reaction and tries to chase the Ray. It does not work.
Then after all that, the Arsenal Guild crashes into Manhattan. No one reacts, so Raiden and Solidus have a duel to the death on top of Federal Hall.
Literally, nobody in Manhattan, the financial district, the busiest part of Manhattan, nobody reacts to the gigantic nuclear submarine that just crashed into Federal Hall, and the ex-president dueling it with a skinny blonde kid with katanas and octopus tentacles and jetpacks. What?! What? What?
Oh, okay, so the Solidus wants Raiden dead so he can track down his nanomachine, and so he uses nanomachines to track down the Patriots to form the ideal nation made up of the Sons of Liberty. Raiden needs to fight because if Solidus dies, the Patriots don't kill Olga's daughter, and what's the point in having katana if you don't use it? Anyway, Raiden wins.
Then, Snake magically appears and tells Raiden that he's got a tracker on Ocelot's Ray. He's going to hunt down the Patriots with the data he got from GW. He also hands Raiden his dog tags and tells him to make his own destiny, I guess? Also, Vamp is hanging out in the background, because apparently if New Yorkers aren't going to react to an enormous terrorist attack, they definitely won't react to a shirtless vampire carrying a million knives. We also forgot to mention that when Snake gives Raiden the katana, please stop giggling at the phallic interpretations, Raiden asks Snake if he doesn't need the katana himself, and Snake points to his bandana and says, "No, kid, I've got infinite ammo," because the bandana got you infinite ammo in MGS1, and the line between video game and reality within the video game is so blurry and gray that I don't know what is what.
So, what is the post-credit scene for this one?
Post-credits, Otacon manages to secure the data disk from, the virus data disk from his sister Emma, that was from GW, and finds out that all the members of the Patriots Wiseman Committee have been dead for 100 years?
What?
Yeah, I don't know either. We'll have to work on that one. But for now, let's talk about the fallout.
Okay, so I think it's fair to say that MGS2 is the most hilariously entertaining of all time.
It's the worst MGS game, but it is so wacky and nonsensical. Okay, I want to talk about it from a gameplay perspective, because that's what always bugs me about the game. The Big Shell is clunky and poorly designed. It's impossible to navigate effectively. Every room looks identical, and there's two of these end on end.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a big figure eight that is identical in every room. It's so impossible to get around.
And because of that, you just get lost. And it's very hard to tell when you've made progression and where you're not. And it does kind of like, I have to imagine to some extent, Kojima might have been trying to make a statement about how like, oh, you're just going through the same motions over and over again. But
I think he was, and I think the problem with Metal Gear Solid 2 that we'll get to is our thesis statement that Metal Gear Solid 2 is a whole bunch of meta, fourth wall breaking, you know, meta-textual, meta-game, meta-narrative wankery attached to the worst game ever.
And the fun part is, it doesn't pay off. You're hearing this hilarity for the first time. Don't play Metal Gear Solid 2.
Don't. Just listen to us. Yeah. The gameplay is actually top-notch, but you rarely get a chance to use any of the cool new tricks Raiden has. We didn't ever talk about the awful part of the game when I mentioned that Raiden was doing 70 hours of errands on the Big Shell. It's because he had to traipse around hunting for hidden bombs while a man on your codec lies and whines about his broken leg that isn't really broken.
And hiding bodies and deactivating cameras doesn't mean much when you're shuffling from cutscene to cutscene every 3 minutes, because this game has to have like one of the longest running times of any Metal Gear Solid cutscene, except for Metal Gear Solid 4, which has the longest.
It's got a pretty high ratio, especially compared to MGS4. The boss fights are mostly underwhelming. In a meta attempt to recreate a crummier version of Metal Gear Solid 1, none of the bosses stand out as anything more than rehashes from the first game. Fortune is an unkillable Vulcan Raven. Vatman is a quicker Revolver Ocelot. Vamp is special.
Yes, there's not much you can do with Vamp.
The sniper fight's a sniper wolf fight, but the part where he's dancing on the water and throwing knives at you, which was intended to be a fight with a guy called Chinaman, and boy am I glad that somebody told Hideo Kojima that was a bad idea.
Well, to be fair, he already made a game in which you went to Zanzibar Island in the middle of Asia, so clearly he wasn't exactly going for racial sensitivities. This whole stuff just ends up being this colossal pileup of bad decisions, poor gameplay, and character moments that don't make a lick of sense.
And it just pissed people off to the point where MGS3 didn't really sell very well because of it. Kojima's temper tantrum of fans wanting more MGS1 turned into an elaborate statement about the nature of games and how they affect us and what they mean to us. It's a lot of really interesting metatextual wankery that isn't actually very interesting or deep, wrapped around a boring game.
So, and I think what's really comes down to is that it does what a lot of comedy games have tried to do, which is like comment on the fact that they like, oh look, it's another warehouse, but then still put that warehouse there.
Right.
You can't have your cake and eat it too. You can't like,
it's not satire when you're doing the thing you're making fun of.
Yeah, at that point you're just recreating the situation for it and then making a crude remark.
The point of MGS2 is, look how miserable this is. Aren't you miserable playing this? You should be miserable. This is miserable. And my takeaway is, yeah, it's miserable, and it's not very like interesting from a metatextual perspective, because all it wants to say is, isn't this miserable?
Speaking of misery, let's get into the game's translation process.
As you might be able to tell, Metal Gear Solid 2 is not a well-liked game.
So its translator, Agnes Kaku, has had to deal with a lot of hate over the years.
You know, I don't know why so much attention is paid to MGS2 and its localization, though, because there's like, how many MGSs are there now?
My producer is saying too many, but I think we're up to six.
I mean, Jeremy Blaustein is, I would say he's really well known. He seems to have really engaged with the fans over the years, which is, you know, something I think is great, but he definitely does not get the hate that I do. But the weird thing is, as far as I know, and this is really not very much, I'm the only person that did two Metal Gear Solid titles, and I was offered a third. I was offered MGS3, and I said no thank you, and you know, ran away. But so I don't really understand why so much not very happy attention is paid to my little bit of work on the Metal Gear franchise, when clearly Konami was happy with my work. They wouldn't give me two and offer me three otherwise. At the time, they were happy with it, I'm sure. And there's like, what, you know, at least two or three other unknown or semi-known localizers, you know, involved in this. It's like, why is there so much attention paid to two?
Agnes is the daughter of a diplomat, so she grew up speaking both Japanese and English.
I was raised in, I guess, seven different countries, so I have a fully installed Japanese and English brain. I graduated college in 96. I moved to Tokyo. I was actually doing, other work, test prep and missions.
Until one day she was looking through the newspaper and found an ad for a job at Intac.
And it said that, you know, do you like video games? Do you like writing? Do you speak both languages? Apply. I did. It turned out to be an agency that did a lot of video game work. And like a lot of people, I made the mistake of thinking this was a way into game development proper.
One of the projects that slid across her desk was a small game called Metal Gear Ghost Babel for the Game Boy Color. It plays more like the older Metal Gear games and doesn't really matter to the overall series.
It does, however, feature a character that fashions corpse dolls out of the severed body parts of his victims. He singles Snake's tendons as his prize.
Konami wanted to make the game kid-friendly, something to get children into the Metal Gear series. You know, serial killers.
To be honest, like, they never told me how to be kid-friendly. You know, I never really got much of an information. I literally just got a bunch of Word files, and that was pretty much it. Nobody ever... In fact, until I did Katamari, like, years later, nobody had ever mentioned ratings to me. So, you know, I'm the wrong person to ask about this kind of stuff, because I was a kid myself. So I suppose I had an idea that, oh, you know, Game Boy, that's my friends' younger brothers are going to be playing with this. So, but, you know, violence has never been considered a problem, right, with the American audience. I mean, it's like you said, he's not allowed to smoke, but he's allowed to go and kill people. And he's allowed to hang out with people who collect, what, tendons, he said?
Yeah.
I don't remember that. Yeah, that's, you know, it's like that's America for you, you know.
What did you know about Metal Gear when that arrived?
Nothing, really. The internet was not what it is now, to say the least. So you couldn't go and actually look this stuff up. Like this, okay, this stuff predates Wikipedia, for God's sakes. You know, like, this is what people have to understand when they criticize me for, you know, not doing. And the best research I could have done was to go and play the original game. However, I had very little money at that point because I had actually given up a lucrative line of work in academic consulting to do this, you know, kind of full time. And the pay was, you know, especially in Tokyo, like it's pretty miserable. So, you know, you make what you make and you don't get it until what, 2 months later. And they were not going to provide me the original game, let alone the, you know, temporary hardware to play with. So, yes, in theory, I should have gone and played the original game, but it would have literally reduced my profit to zero, I think, at that point.
Why did you abandon that other job for game localization?
Because writing takes a lot of work, especially when you have to do a lot of research yourself. You know, like I said, if you're not really getting all this information bundled up nicely by the client and you can't talk to... The client, I mean, would be Intact, this agency. You can't talk to them, really, about this stuff. You have no access to Konami. So you're spending a lot of time trying to do a good job. Like, if I just sat there and said, okay, I'll just replace this a Japanese word with one of several comparable English words, yeah, I probably could have, you know, continued to do other work and done this on the side. But I really was writing full-time at that point. It just wasn't making much more than, I don't know, $2,500 US a month at most. You know, I mean, it's pretty bad. I was living off savings a lot during that time.
Regardless, her translations remained stellar, and she built a good reputation at Intac.
So they gave her a lot of games to work on.
And we aren't kidding. She worked on a lot of games.
Yeah, it starts in 98. It was a Goemon game, but that was just some tangential material. Microman, Votoms, Chorokyu game, LA Machine Guns. Ah, NHL Blades of Steel, House of Dead, Bass Fishing. And Hybrid Heaven was my first big one. Then I did something called Spike Out.
Trust us when we say the list keeps going for a while.
Then came Metal Gear Solid 2. This was the massive new title coming from Hideo Kojima. It was going to be a premier title on the PS2. It was the reason that some people bought the console.
Intact liked Agnes, and they had this exclusive contract going with Konami. So they offered it to her.
By the time I'd started working on it, the buzz was starting to build, you know, the marketing machine was going, and I thought, holy shoot, this is going to be pretty big, and so this is going to be my big break, kind of. I can take this and go somewhere with it. So while I was working on it, I was actually feeling very excited about this.
What a lot of people don't get is that while it's a well-known series now, MGS wasn't that big in 2001.
People like it, but as much as we talk up the hype, games were still a small industry, and within it, Kojima was kind of this weirdo.
So when MGS 2 included insane jargon around the Patriots,
or that whole deal around the artificial intelligence,
or how the whole game turns out to be an elaborate simulation,
Agnes really had little idea what she walked into.
No one gave her a copy of the early games, and she couldn't afford them.
So she was left with an absurd script that kept tripping into cliché.
The thing is that I know it's now considered a postmodern masterpiece or whatever, but if you read it, you know, in a professional capacity, whether you're an editor or you're a localizer or you're a script doctor, all of which I've been, you see the tricks of the trade. And so you break it down in your head, you know, things that are actually new versus, oh, here's a rip from the headlines, you know, especially when something is being written, like, in the same time period. You know, I mean, I did not find it abstruse in any way. I'm sorry if that's disappointing to hear, but I'm not saying it was so dumb that I found it simple. It's not that. I just don't remember reading it and thinking, wow, how am I going to express this? It was just, you know, I think cosmetics ads are harder, actually.
From that perspective, I just feel like it's hard to follow from any kind of plot standpoint. I was just, I guess I was just wondering, like, if that made it more difficult to then kind of approach and break it down into how you would then give that to another audience.
Well, you have to remember that I did not get the Japanese copy of the game or a build. So this wasn't presented to me in any kind of a game fashion sort of linear. I just got a bunch of files completely out of order in some cases. You're given like 12 files inside the file. Yes, it's in, you know, something of a linear order and has tags like that'll say opening or, you know, ending or kernel crazy or whatever. But you don't really know exactly where the branches are or any of that stuff. You can't care about trying to understand it, unfortunately, if the client gives it to you in that kind of a condition. It's like you're writing a bunch of mini sketches. You hope that it comes together, but there's only so much you can do.
Then there was this other problem, the character limit. So however nuts the script sounded before she translated it, she wasn't given much room to make it any better.
It's also a logistical nightmare because you're actually spending twice the time to get it shorter. But you're getting paid per moji or words. Now, because I was young and stupid, I was actually getting paid by the English words. Which meant you're spending twice, you know, the time to get paid half as much. The word limit getting in the way would be pretty much everything. Yeah, but I mean, I remember at first I tried to argue because I thought I could actually do some pushback. Like the, you know, that's been talked about, but the whole sneak suit and the sneak point. I didn't think it was a big deal to have it changed. Presumably because I hadn't, you know, looked at the original game. I also, in the files I submitted, I spelled the main character's name, Leiden, as L-E-Y, or L-E-I-D-N, or L-E-Y-D-N. Because I did not think it was going to be named, like, Raiden? I mean, that's not a very good name, even if you're a sumo wrestler.
She did try to make the women of MGS2 tolerable, though.
The characters of Rose, Olga, and Mei Ling range from stereotypes to beings of intense cruelty.
So that was where Agnes made her push.
She couldn't change the game's plot, but she could change the tone of these women.
The female characters are written not as characters, but just as something that goes down easy. You know, they're just fillers in many cases, except for maybe Olga or somebody like that. That bothers me because you definitely see the differences. Like even though they're all cliches, basically, or all based on some Hollywood character that's a cliche, the women are line, you know, they're charcoal sketches. The men get watercolor, I guess. You know, those kinds of differences. You can't help but notice it if you go over the text again and again. You know, not as a consumer, but as somebody who's working on it.
You can't change Rose's actions, but you can change at least her tone in certain conversations. Did you attempt to try at least mitigate the damage?
With Rose, it's really difficult because her words are mostly functional. So you can't change the fact that she's like nagging her boy toy, you know, while he's on mission. you can't really change that. You can't have her instead say, oh, new information from HQ, or, you know, so it's just like, Raiden, we have to talk about our relationship right now. You can't really change that. I mean, you can, you know, you can dress it up maybe clinically and be like, it occurs to me that our relationship bears some scrutiny at this point. I mean, that's but still inappropriate. She's still doing something really inappropriate and bizarre.
After we've been together in my room, you stay awake all night or you head for the door.
Is this really the time to bring this up?
Now with Mei Ling, you know, I just bumped up her, you know, her educational background. That took, nobody noticed that one, so that kind of... But she's basically like, I mean, she should also be an AI. I mean, she's basically your, you know, not so manic Asian pixie dream girl.
Was Olga any different?
Kind of interesting, at least for a while, like in the 90s and early UIs. If you were Russian, you could defy the laws of gender gravity. It's like the character in The Jackal with Bruce Willis, which is not a very good movie, but it has some moments. So, no, she's like a Russian colonel, so it's okay.
I think you deserve a little credit. No one's ever dodged that shot of mine. But no one gets lucky twice, either.
After that, Agnes was done.
This was the last game she translated with Intac.
And Metal Gear Solid 2 didn't really help her career. Few people knew about the series.
Eventually, she just took it off her resume.
I got paid about $5,000 US for 2 months, 2.5 months of, you know, crunch time work, out of which you pay your own tax expenses. So the take was pretty horrible, as you can imagine. I mean, yeah, that's all. But that was actually the most I'd ever been paid for a game at that point, because the other titles paid even worse. And when I finished and I had a talk with the agency and they made it very, very clear that, you know, they liked me doing exactly what I was doing and they were not really going to, you know, like there wasn't going to be any kind of anything to break into. So that's when Metal Gear Solid 2 convinced me to leave game localization. At that point, I was like, okay, this is just, you know, you need to just forget about the last few years and start over. So I went to IDG, International Data Group. They published PC World and Mac World and Dummies Books back then and all that stuff. I became a tech editor, and then after 6 months, I actually became their web design manager. And it wasn't until, you know, this guy I'd known at Intact who'd moved on to Bandai Namco just hunted me down and said, you need to do this thing called, you know, Katamari, that I touched a game or did, you know, even worked with the Japanese source text.
She got back into games with Katamari Damacy and Final Fantasy XIV, A Realm Reborn. At one point, she also did some translation for the Japanese government after the tsunami in 2011.
So you've worked with governments, you've worked with magazines, you've spent this time as a tech editor, and yet I think it's fair to say that MGS2 is probably what you're most known for, and I think we can all agree that it's not really a high art project. What do you make of that game's legacy with you?
I wish people would explain the hagiography of, you know, Metal Gear Solid 2 to me, because I don't get that part. I really don't quite understand why I'm so known for it.
I think that if there's anyone who's going to be able to answer this, it's probably Daniel, so I'm going to hand this over to him for a sec.
Hi there. My best guess for that is I think Metal Gear Solid 2 was something that really sort of bugged people because it was so sort of strange and confusing and offered a lot of questions. And I mean, you have sort of characters who are like Raiden and Rose who, you know, for a lot of people who don't necessarily see the problematic, you know, gendered aspects of Rose, they just sort of see her as annoying and they see Raiden as whiny. And so a lot of people got very angry about that. And they still are very angry about that. I think there's a certain point where people sort of see it's like, oh, this is bad. And, oh, you worked on this bad thing. I think there's also a certain element of people, you know, the gamer culture is very dude bro-y. And I think that they see that your name is put next to this game they don't like, and you have, say, somebody, you know, a Jeremy Blaustein or, you know, somebody else, a male name is put next to the games they do like, and I think that sort of triggers this really garbage reaction in their brains.
Well, you know, that makes sense. And what you said about Rose and Raiden also makes sense. I mean, and I suppose they were, I think obviously Kojima heard the fan reaction because three went right back to Snake all the time. And the latest one was like the let's turn our friends into diamonds one. That's like all Snake all the time too, right? So it's the guy heard you. So that's probably a good, you know, yeah, indication that these fans should let go of their anger because it worked.
In 2012, a guy at Hardcore Gaming wanted an interview with Agnes about her work on MGS2.
She did, and later he came back. He was writing an old book at Old Japanese Games and wanted to talk to her again.
Agnes decided to help out, but the whole deal went sour.
Look it up online and you'll see both sides.
But Agnes is now suing the writer for libel.
Well, my time working on games is effectively over. What's really unfortunate is that because of these really extreme false claims made about me on a very search engine friendly platform, what's really unfortunate about that is that it basically does make me untouchable in, you know, and I mean that in a caste system sense, not a sporting sense. I'm basically not able to work as a game localizer. I'm actually not able to work as a great many things. And I think a lot of a lot of people who've experienced online stalking can really understand where I'm coming from. But it really does affect every aspect of your life in a way that, you know, you just don't expect. Like when you guys contacted me, for example, I thought, oh no, here's another phishing exploration, because, you know, I've actually gotten that, basically people just trying to, you know, kind of engage me in a dishonest way. So, you know, you learn to distrust people. And professionally, in terms of games, I am pretty much ruined. So maybe my relationship with the community does not matter at this point, because it's very much done. And I know that a lot of people in the community think suing for libel is rather an extreme reaction, but I won't get into it, but this doesn't involve just me. This involves people that I got into this project who had no idea that games can be such a volatile place where, you know, like flaming and trolling is considered business as usual, and people don't really think about long-term reactions. Like, this is actually ruining people's lives and livelihood. Anyway, the suit has been, it's been difficult. It's been interesting for me as well, because I do believe in doing the right thing. And the right thing often looks very unappealing to other people.
I guess my last question isn't going to be, do you regret working on this game? You've gotten no end of grief for it. A lot of people don't consider the translation to be top work. What do you feel about having had that project?
Like, the criticism of the actual, like, the language thing doesn't bother me at all, because most people are not even aware I'm bi-native. So when I see, you know, like people making elaborate little, trying to make memes online, you know, proving that I don't speak a word of Japanese, I think, well, let's get you on the horn and who really speaks Japanese, because, you know, 日本語を話せないと思ったら本当に自分で話してみて、それで確認したらどう? I mean, that would be my feeling, right? You know? So the language criticism is like so off base for me that it doesn't bother me at all. And it hasn't hurt me professionally because it's just ridiculous. The hate mail and the nastiness, obviously nobody enjoys being called the C word, the B word. But yes, I actually do regret working on Metal Gear Solid 2 because of the thing we just sort of tangentially talked about. Because it's brought really troubled people into my orbit. So that's what I mean. Yeah, I definitely at this point regret doing Metal Gear Solid 2. It is not worth this. It is not worth being lied about, threatened, drained of money and time you know, and it's only Metal Gear Solid that's done this. No Katamari fan has ever tried to hurt me. Same thing with, I mean, God, you know, Hybrid Heaven looks great now compared to MGS2. Like, you don't have any, like, weird people trying to suck up to you and then destroy your life. I mean, bring on Hybrid Heaven fans wherever they are, or Azure Dreams, or they all seem to just have nice memories of playing the game.
Agnes Kaku is a writer and translator of Metal Gear Solid 2.
You can find her on Twitter at Agnes Kaku. So, let's talk a little bit about the legacy of MGS2.
Because I think it does have this trail behind it that, in which it's not exactly the happiest game. It kind of built this... It became notorious. It became this object of like, hey, look, this is what a crazy game from Japan looks like.
Right. I also think, at least within the Metal Gear series, it was, you know, basically it set the tone for Metal Gear from there on. It's like, okay, Metal Gear is now a series about weird, nonsensical plots with these big cutscenes and lots of story that doesn't really make any sense, and you have to be super into it to get it at all.
Every Metal Gear Solid game from here on in, 3 and 4, has to go back and try to, like, fix parts of 2 because they make no sense whatsoever.
There's retconning out the wazoo.
Because Metal Gear Solid 2 just turns out, I mean, as we said, it turns out to be a simulation
and
to some extent.
Kojima, again, didn't want to make a Metal Gear Solid 2 in the first place, but he made it because he was kind of in that mood. He did not want to make MGS3. This was supposed to be the last game. You were supposed to be left with all these questions.
But then, for some reason, he keeps doing this, where he ends
every
up...
Every Metal Gear game is his last Metal Gear game.
And then they make a new Metal Gear game. I mean, this keeps happening. And I think Metal Gear Solid 2 was the place where he was the least honest about his intentions to make another one. Mm-hmm. Where I think that when he says, I'm not going to make a new Metal Gear game, he means, I am not going to make a new Metal Gear game until someone either shows him a check or someone tries to make their own Metal Gear game.
Yeah, I think what happens is that Konami makes a Metal Gear game and he says, oh, no, you can't do that without me. That's impossible. You can't. And he attaches himself to the project.
And then just Metal Gear gets crazier and crazier as he starts to like lose faith in the fan base, as he gets angry with the people he's working with, as the all this stuff gets just funneled into the game itself. And MGS2 is the highlight of that experience of seeing kind of like what happens when Kojima gets mad.
I think it's definitely MGS2 is sort of a highlight of Kojima's excess. MGS4 is that too, but in a different way. MGS, because Hideo Kojima is such a fascinating person in that he is a guy who loves military and guns, who grew up in a country without weapons, without guns. He loves movies, but made games, and he can't stop making games, and all he wants to do is make a movie.
He keeps making these contradictions in his, and it's so hard to follow him after that, to some extent, just because you get kind of lost in what does he actually want to do.
And so you get MGS4, which is basically a movie with some gameplay tacked onto it, and MGS2, which is trying to be this elaborate state, because he wants to be more intelligent, but I think the problem is that he doesn't actually have anything interesting to say about games, because he doesn't really care about games, beyond the core mechanical perspective.
Which, I mean, I think as we get into the future Metal Gear games, they do actually become more mechanically interesting, which may have to do with more people being involved in the project. But also, like by the most modern ones, Metal Gear Solid 5, we start to see with Ground Zeroes, that's probably the most mechanically interesting of all the Metal Gear
and
games.
And has the absolute least to say about, you know, the games as a meta-narrative.
No, as the series seems to go on, it seems to have less care about the meta-narrative aspect of it.
Which is fine, because I don't think Kojima was ever very good at that.
I just also think that Kojima, this is a game that's often referred to as a postmodern masterpiece of some kind.
It's not.
It's no kind of masterpiece, because it doesn't even execute on its own ambitions very well. It doesn't go back... In some ways, Metal Gear Solid 1 has better postmodern elements in that it causes you to think about your PlayStation as this device that is part of the game. All Metal Gear Solid 2 is just get frustrated with its own mechanics.
Yeah.
If the intention is, oh, deconstruction through frustration, there's that isn't even done well when it's done in other mediums. The idea of, like, House of Leaves, for instance, which is, like, the hallmark book you read when you get out of university to show how postmodern you are.
Mm-hmm.
It's got aspects of... it's part of it is written upside down. Part of it is written on notepads. And all of that stuff just comes together to feel like this juvenile mess of a book that, like, at first glance, it's... I would say House of Leaves is better done than something like Metal Gear.
Metal Gear Solid 2, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's a more, but it feels very juvenile as a result, because it tries to, like, deconstruct the book, and all it does is make aspects of reading harder and less interesting.
Right. It's the problem with MGS2 is that it does feel like, and it does sort of feel like baby's first postmodernism in a lot of ways, but because of that, it's hailed for some reason among games, just like, we have better postmodern games, and don't say BioShock.
No, it's not
you. I wasn't saying you. I'm talking to the internet.
Yeah.
Don't you dare say BioShock. Neither of those are exactly postmodern masterpieces, but at least that one isn't about pissing you off.
Yeah,
with
yeah.
its, you know, with its faux intellectual wankery.
The thing with, I feel like the reason this game got highlighted is because around the time it was coming out, it was PlayStation 2, 2001. We were just starting to see games that kind of had this authorial intent with a highlight. Like, there had been games with authorial intent. I mean, like, look at D2. Mm-hmm. The Enko had, he had this, whatever he made, his name was written all over it.
Kenji Ino, yeah.
Yeah, Kenji Ino. But what with, this was the most high-profile games that you would see with a massive authorial intent written top and center, aside from maybe David Cage later on.
Well, the poster at E3 had Hideo Kojima's name on it, and coming back to that arrogance thing, like, Hideo Kojima made sure you saw his name in MGS1. He didn't care if you skipped the credits. He didn't care because his name was in the Psycho Mantis fight, the most memorable part of that game. Kojima, for all his arrogance, is a savvy businessman. He knows how to sell himself.
He knows how to sell himself, and I think that often gets away in his, maybe any artistic vision he might have.
Well, yeah.
The fact is that he cares a lot about making himself look good and not so much about... I mean, like, look, that joke he made in Metal Gear Solid 1 about Hideo over video, that is just self-aggrandizing. There's not, like, unless you... You made the leap of, oh, that's a funny pun because it's Hideo and not video. You don't, it's not really like, you don't even really make that leap. Mm-hmm. He just wanted to make his name plastered in the middle of a TV screen.
Which is not necessarily a problem. That's cutesy and whatever. But when it does get in the way of, you know, making a good piece of, if not art, at the very least entertainment, or at the very least trying to make some piece of high art that is really just juvenile and ridiculous and also terribly unentertaining, you know, except for the part where you can make fun of it. What are you left with? Metal Gear Solid 2, Sons of Liberty.
Yeah.
You do, for whatever reason, want to play Sons of Liberty, play the HD remake. It's got an achievement when you lock yourself in a locker with a picture of a woman and you try to kiss it. You get the achievement. It's called Snake Beater. So, I mean, congratulations for that. Juvenile jokes for a juvenile game.
Jesus. And I just kind of want to track how this game had a knot of negative impacts. Mm-hmm. It was a huge fan outcry. It
just took a giant bite out of MGS3's sales, which sucks because we'll be getting to it next, but MGS3 is the best Metal Gear game.
Yeah, and I mean, it left Agnes Kaku in a bad state.
Yeah, absolutely.
The translation of that game makes very little sense as a result of kind of having to go through another filter on top of it, Kojima's own madness.
Mm-hmm.
It's like... then when they had to go for future games, like Ryan Payton had to kind of end up going to, when he was translating MGS4, had to go back and kind of like rebuild what that game even like meant. Mm-hmm. Because it's just so hard to follow. As a result, I feel like MGS2 is probably it's weird how that game sets the tone for the rest of the series and what people think of like as a Japanese game.
Oh yeah.
But at the same time, it is easily the worst parts and highlights all of Kojima's successes.
Yeah. Well, next time, we'll be taking a trip back to the Cold War in the 60s to hang out with Operation Snake Eater, and then jumping to the far-flung future of 2014 to finally deal with the Patriots.
I stare at the stars and the sky up above and think, what am I? What am I made of? Am I full of sorrow? Am I hurt?
That's all for this week. I'm producer Armin Iqbali.
And I'm features editor Daniel Rosen. Built to Play was made with the help of
Agnes Kaku.
For the rest of the Metal Gear Solaga, as well as previous episodes and interviews, be sure to check out our website, builttoplay.ca, Rail on Stitch Radio, and iTunes. Leave us a review so we know how we're doing and more people can find the show.
While you're there, check the archives for articles about games, love, open worlds, localization, and virtual reality. It's all part of a little thing we're calling Built to Play Volume 1.
And make sure to follow us on Twitter at Built to Play and to find out when we'll be back with Built to Play Volume 2 XX
Alpha Gold Dash Hyper Built to Play 4. Until then, watch out for more Metal Gear.
You can follow me personally at Flarkon, that's FLRKCON.
And I'm at Daniel_Rosen. And remember, it was all simulation. Brother. Thank you so much for listening.
I stare at the stars and the sky.